So when was your last checkup? Oh no, not you. Although that's important too, but when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule an appointment today.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. There's a new CNN original series, so very entertaining, called The History of the Sitcom. Now, it reunites audiences with the television friends, families, and coworkers they grew up with while introducing cutting-edge comedies that are sure to be your next binge watch. The eight-part docuseries features over 180 original interviews with sitcom icons, breaking down how the shows have helped generations of Americans navigate an ever-shifting cultural landscape. The brilliant guy behind it all is my pal, Bill Carter, and he joins us now. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the Story of Late Night docuseries that aired earlier in the year was outstanding, and you might have topped it with The History of the Sitcom.
Well, you know, I can tell you one thing. We can give people two extra episodes, so that's great for them.
Right.
We also have a lot of territory to cover. I was telling somebody, like, if you think about the history of late night, you might have to talk about 25, 30 shows. In sitcoms, you'd need 2,500 or 3,000 shows.
Yeah, that's right.
It's quite a landscape.
It is. It absolutely is. Nearly 200 interviews from A-list stars and producers from the past and present, and some faces we haven't seen in a while. It's really been fun to watch.
Well, this is what's been great. I mean, you know, you take this project on, you can't guarantee that people are going to say, yeah, I want to talk about that. But I think because we've done the late night one and people like that, that was part of the reason. But also, they like talking about this. I mean, it was fascinating because many of the biggest stars you can think of that we had in these shows, and we had everybody from Bob Newhart to Tina Fey to, you know, Ted Danson, they themselves grew up, you know, after school watching Lucy or The Honeymooners or whatever.
Right.
And they love sitcoms. They love them and they love talking about them. And they're very engaged with it. And so it was really great that so many of them, you know, decided that they would talk to us and gave us so much great material.
As I say, the series airs every Sunday at 8 Central through August 22nd. The first ones aired last week called A Family Matter, focusing on the ever-changing family, as you said.
Yes, that was the first one. And then we did Changing Sexual Attitudes in the second one that ran last weekend. And this week, the show... The next one, the third one, is about the how friends is like the central theme of many shows, the gang, you know, the group of people that hang out together, How I Met Your Mother and shows like that.
You immediately, in A Family Matter, called out the fact that not only did I Love Lucy set the tone for American sitcom production, but it also did tell the story of a growing American family.
It was unquestionably, and how you started out that a lot of that is interesting because they moved from the city to the suburbs, right?
Right, right.
And that was what was going on. That was going on at the same time. And Lucille Ball did, in fact, have a baby during that time. She already had a daughter, but they didn't incorporate her into the series, but they incorporated their son into the series. So it was a living, organic thing that as was playing out. And of course, in that era, in the early 50s, you had all of that exploding in America because you had all these World War II guys that had come home, starting families, moving to the suburbs. It was completely in the wheelhouse of what was happening in America.
Many of those family sitcoms, the early days, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet, was an imprint of almost like an ideal American family. Certainly was not diverse back then, but almost not true to life, but it did give us some comfort food, didn't it?
Well, that was part of the idea was it was idealized, right? You know, here's what an American family's like, you know, and they have a picket fence and they have a big house and the wife wears a dress every day, even running around the house. That it was totally idealized.
That began to evolve in the 1960s. And although we saw a lot of family comedies, I think about all the single parents that all of a sudden popped up. You know, you're talking about Andy Griffith, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, Family Affair, Diane Carroll. And Julia was widowed in the late, you know, things were just starting to pivot in the 1960s.
And interestingly, we deal with this a bit because, you know, the idea of a widow was, or a widower was, okay, we can do that. So, you know, Fred McMurray in My Three Sons, his wife has passed away, right?
Right.
And that, how do you make that a comedy? Because that's pretty awful for this family. So you just have to sort of establish it and then move on. Just move on. So you didn't see a whole lot of divorced people.
No.
Until later. And interestingly, the Brady Bunch was originally supposed to be the guy who had been widowed, but the woman had been divorced. And they were like, people don't like this, so we're not going to say what happened to the guy.
I know. I think at some point they said Mike Brady was widowed, but there was never a mention of Carol's husband again. Like, if they were, what a deadbeat dad never showing up to see his girls. I never understood
it. Exactly.
The 70s brought various views into the American family. Happy Days in the 50s, then All in the Family, Good Times. The family, it was almost like in the 70s, the family was becoming less perfect and a little bit more relatable.
Well, they're willing to accept the fact that that is an unrealistic portrait. And, of course, Norman Lear, who was absolutely brilliant and wonderful to sit for an interview for us when he was 99 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's turned 100 by now. And is extraordinary, by the way. Unbelievably sharp guy still. He recognized in a British show, which had the Archie Bunker type character, that that was his family. His father was bigoted that way. And why haven't we seen that on TV?
Yeah.
And he decides to put it on TV and go after it, and really go after it. And then he creates an ethnic, a black family, and he did a Hispanic family. He's expanded the view of American family, and that was critical. And that was in the early 70s that happened, and that opened a million doors because it worked. People didn't say, oh, my gosh, I don't want to see this family. No, it was the number one show on television.
It was. In Good Times, I mean, there was, you know, always arguing behind the scenes on how an African-American family is being portrayed. But The Cosby Show made such a big splash in the 80s. It was appealing to the entire American audience. It was a successful, hardworking family. Didn't tackle race issues directly, but it kind of cracked open the door to change the way black people are perceived. And it broke some serious ground.
No question. And again, a show where one network didn't want to take a chance on it. ABC passes on it. NBC puts it on. And it's not only the number one show, it's the last show in television history that had a 50 share.
That's
half
crazy.
The country is watching the show.
Yeah.
It was so explosively popular. And it was popular because it was funny. And you thought the people in it were appealing and they loved each other. That was obvious and evident. And I think that just translated to any group, any people watching it. And families watched it together. That was another incredible thing.
It's true.
They all sat down and watched that show together.
You had Roseanne, Working Class Family, you know, Full House, Family Matters, Everybody Loves Raymond, to a very different Modern Family. I think that was another show that really kind of changed the landscape on, you know, what a family actually consists of and what they're made of, and very different people.
When you see that pilot of Modern Family, which is one of the great pilots of all time, and the gay couple at the end, when the guy raises the baby like a Lion King, it is so explosively funny that it doesn't matter what your prejudices are, whatever you say, oh, that's funny. These are funny guys.
So true.
And that is such the key of making all of this work. And it should not be ever undervalued that the best shows, the very best comedies are long lasting because you can tune them in at any time and see 5 minutes and there'll be laughs in it.
Absolutely. We're talking to executive producer Bill Carter of CNN's The History of the Sitcom. Sunday nights at 8 Central, and there's more after the news next on 720 WGN. State Player back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to executive producer Bill Carter on the new CNN docuseries, The History of the Sitcom. Bill, the next episode aired was Sex in the Sitcom, really from I Dream of Jeannie, which I didn't expect to be a part of that, and Sex in the City and beyond.
Yeah, well, the I Dream of Jeannie aspect is interesting because I don't think people thought of it as anything except kind of a silly fantasy comedy, right?
Right.
But actually, it was fascinating in terms of what they were saying about women. I mean, this is a woman who actually is way more powerful than the man.
Yeah,
she can
so
do
much
anything.
So. That's right. That's right.
And yet, what was she was doing? She was like making his breakfast and keeping house for him. And it was very interesting that they were like limiting her in that same way. And they did the same thing with Bewitched, where the woman was she was the central character and she could do anything she wanted, but she wanted to be married to this guy and have a family. And they were still sort of emphasizing that sort of ideal. And from there, you see the expanding roles of women across the breadth of you know, professions, et cetera, but also taking charge of their lives. And yes, they're single women and they meet guys and they have relationships and all that. which could not have happened in the 50s and 60s. Until the point you get to a show like Girls, and it's just...
Right.
Can you imagine someone in the 60s watching that?
Right, like, yeah, yeah.
So the change is vast. It was really immense. And sitcoms were like leading the way, like opening people's eyes throughout that period.
Absolutely. Next episode is this Sunday is Just Friends, and I saw the screener, my favorite thus far, because it really embodied the shows I grew up with in the late 70s and 80s and 90s. And we all think of Friends when the title is Just Friends, but you open with Seinfeld, and that was probably the ultimate true blue group of Friends and timeless.
Yeah, exactly, and unique because they were not on television because they were super appealing people. Okay, self-oriented, narrow people who had very little things going on in their lives, but it was just explosively funny, and they didn't care if you came away learning anything. They didn't want you to learn anything from the episode.
Right.
They just wanted to entertain you down to your toes. And they did it week after week at such an incredibly high level. And it was a unique group of people, but you could see yourself kind of fitting in with them. Well, at least I could a little bit. I grew up in New York. And I was like, you know, I know people like this. This is typical.
That's
great. Fighting over a parking space? Yes, of course that happens all the time.
Of course, absolutely.
So, yeah, I identified with it. And I really, that's really at the top of my list for greatness in comedy.
You focus a lot on Gary Marshall because, you know, he created so many of those Friends sitcoms, you know, starting with The Odd Couple, which was an interesting twist. And, of course, bringing up the fact that these two gentlemen were divorced. You had Marion Ross opened the conversation about Happy Days, which was Friends from a classic era, and that spun off, you know, other classic Friends like Laverne and Shirley, which was hearkening back to the days, really, of Lucy and Ethel.
Absolutely. I got to tell you, you've seen it, but there's a scene with Laverne and Shirley trying to make up a hospital bed in that.
Yeah.
And that is worthy of Lucy. That is worth Lucy and Ethel. That is phenomenal physical comedy. Great for them to try that. Fantastic for them to sort of go back to that well. And Gary Marshall's very underrated. He did a lot of very good material. And interestingly, another story that'll come up later is that he created Mork and Mindy because his young son at the time just threw out, well, what if an alien showed up?
I love that.
Wake it up. Let's try that.
I love that. You had Ernest Lee Thomas, who starred in and talked about the show What's Happening. And same when ABC wanted to tell the story of black teenagers, which brought in a young black audience. Yet he said when he goes to autograph shows, it's a bunch of white guys who ask for autographs. Yeah. But it does really say that friendship, especially on television, has no color.
It does. It shouldn't. It shouldn't. But interestingly, of course, Seinfeld and Friends were both, you know, criticized, or at least it was taken note of, that they're living in New York City, and you almost never see a black person.
Yeah.
That is weird and bizarre, and I do think that would never happen again. I think people would be conscious of that. So, like, when you did, for example, New Girl, which came along later, which is another gang comedy, you know, one of the roommates is a black guy. So that's way more typical of our experience today. But the consciousness wasn't there at the time. I mean, there's no black regulars in Mary Tyler Moore either, you know, or even in MASH. There's no black regulars.
No.
So.
No, the 80s brought the Facts of Life, the Friends at Cheers. I mean, you talk about everybody hanging out at the bar. You know, there's just different concepts out there, living single, girlfriends. The recipe for these shows just always have been successful.
Yes. And I think, again, what's very clear that there was something going on then that is not going on now, which is that a show is expected to produce at least 22 to 25 episodes a year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now a lot of comedies will produce that in total streaming.
Yeah.
But you need, especially when you have a group of characters, you need time to establish the character and why that character, he or she, is funny. What is funny about them takes a little bit of time, both for the writer and the actor, to figure out, oh, all right, so that's what is the element of this person that's funny. Sometimes you can introduce a character that's funny right away. Like Lilith on Cheers,
right.
who was, you know, that she was funny the first. I happened to be there the night she was introduced, so I remember this.
Wow.
And she was just screamingly funny, Bebe Neuwirth, the actress. But in general, generally speaking, like, they didn't know Fonz was funny. They didn't know what he was.
Right.
They had no idea until they developed it and developed it. And it does take time, especially with these group shows, where you say, okay, now I get where that guy fits and why he's funny and why is George Costanza funny? Well, after 7 or 8 episodes, you're laughing before he speaks.
So true.
You get it already.
So true. Golden Girls was another one that I'm just amazed how much younger audiences, my daughter's 15, loves watching the Golden Girls, and I knew it was popular with college kids back when, but at a time where TV executives always want to pull in a younger audience and still do, I just, it surprises me that somebody signed off on that show and it was one of the most successful shows in television history.
It is fascinating, and it tells you something that really should have been in the front of mind for every development executive in network history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it hugely funny, and it doesn't matter.
No,
it doesn't matter if they're in high school or if they're in a retirement home. If it is hugely funny, and that show was big laugh funny consistently.
Yeah.
That works. That always works. Ask Noel Coward or ask, you know, Shakespeare or Oscar Wilde or whatever. They wrote comedies that were sitcoms in their way, right? And they delivered funny material, and that is the essence of it. If you can do that, then everything else will work. Everything else.
Working for Laughs is the next episode, the dynamic and friends you meet in the American workplace. And you go all the way back to Armis Brooks, you know, in the classroom, the Dick Van Dyke Show, Mary Tyler Moore, Barney Miller, Taxi, 30 Rock, The Office, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Veep. I mean, these are all, you know, it's very relatable because, you know, you have work friends. And these shows just kind of, those were the shows that I think had a lot of water cooler moments because it was so relatable.
Exactly. Most people have worked in some group setting like that in their lives. And it was very interesting when they created The Office because there was some feeling like it really was a smash from the beginning, even though it struggled overall, with young guys in college. Now, they hadn't worked in offices, but they recognized the type.
Yeah.
It was a type of character that they could recognize. And when you could capture that in that kind of setting, as people who worked in office would say, oh, God, yeah, that woman is just like so-and-so. You know, it really hits people, and they relate to it, and they can say, I know why this is going to be funny. I know this person. It feels genuine. It doesn't feel manufactured. When a comedy feels manufactured, to me, it never works because people say, no, that's not a real person. That's a cartoon. That should be in The Simpsons. That's a cartoon. That's not a real person.
Right. We're talking executive producer Bill Carter of CNN's The History of the Sitcom. Sunday nights at 8 Central, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking executive producer Bill Carter of CNN's The History of the Sitcom. It airs Sunday nights at 8 Central through the end of August. The next episode that you've got is Facing Race, really addressing diversity and paving the way for progress.
Yes, and really, I think this is a really interesting episode because, you know, I think people understand about the fact that initially there were very few black characters and, you know, Diane Carroll was the first lead in a show and they made her, she even said they made me, a white Negro is the way she put it.
Right.
And she actually had a nervous breakdown over trying to play that kind of character.
Wow.
It's actually quite interesting. But I mean, we deal with everything. We deal with Amos and Andy, for example, and Amos and Andy, most people don't know, certainly younger people have not seen it because it eventually was taken off television, but it was extremely popular and it was a radio show where two white guys had played the characters. And when they first did the show for TV, they tried to use those guys in blackface. It was crazy.
It's ridiculous.
How crazy
awful,
it was.
Awful.
Crazy. But they then did the show with some very gifted black actors who were very funny. When I was a kid, that show was still on in syndication. And it would make you laugh, but you could see the unbelievable stereotyping going on there. And, you know, that was an incremental story. How do we change American attitudes or make more acceptance, but do it incrementally? Because, you know, you couldn't have come out with, you know, Good Times in 1950. You couldn't have done that. It just wouldn't work. And one of the interesting things, Dave, is a key factor was that where new networks came along. Fox Network came along. The WB came along. UPN came along. And all those networks, when they started out, said, let's do a specific black show because black Americans watch a lot of TV and they don't see it elsewhere. And each one of those networks put a stake in the ground by being able to establish a black family sitcom.
Moving on up, Upward Mobility, Working Class, The American Dream. That's the next one.
Yes. And of course, Class, you can't talk about Class on TV without talking about The Honeymooners.
Right.
Because The Honeymooners showed really the working class America, with a struggling working class America in an apartment where they didn't even have a refrigerator and an icebox.
Mm-hmm.
And a struggling guy, a struggling blue collar guy who, you know, is desperate to move on up. And it goes to something like the Jeffersons with that famous theme song of Moving On Up.
Right.
And they emerge from the same kind of struggle and they become well off and they're an African American family. And then you have the Cosby Show, which is, you know, a show where they're upper class. That becomes an upper class show. And Class is a very interesting story in America. Roseanne. Look at Roseanne.
Absolutely.
Roseanne is entirely a class-based show. I mean, Malcolm in the Middle is another show like that, which deals with, you know, people who aren't elite people. They aren't college people. They're just regular Americans who are trying to do better for their kids. And, again, a very interesting topic that some very creative people took on.
The last two episodes, one is Freak, Geeks, and Outsiders, Aliens, Geeks, Monsters, Immigrants, Witches, you know, kind of fish out of water stories and new insights into the ever-changing face of America.
That's, of course, a classic comedy theme is to take the fish out of water, right?
Right.
And television tried this in a million ways. They tried, you know, the Munsters, and they tried the Addams Family, and they did Aliens, and they did Foreigners, you know, Latka Gravis in Taxi, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But they also did nerdy characters. That was more recently in Big Bang Theory. I mean, those people are outsiders. And a character like Dwight Schrute in The Office, who's clearly a weird character, right? And when it feels genuine and not just a comic device, then it becomes iconic, and you really can relate to those characters. I mean, It's incredibly good a device to look at America, for example, in like a show like Third Rock from the Sun, where you have these aliens, right? Mm-hmm. And they're trying to look at, and you see these, and the way they relate to certain, you know, essences of American culture is shining a spotlight on that. And it's a very clever way to write comedy, and it's a really interesting theme for the show to explore, because if you go through sitcom history, there are hundreds of these shows.
There are. Yeah.
If you really break them down, Witches and everything else.
Escaping Reality. And this one's a little bit related to the episode before that, too, because it's something different. It's like Gilligan's Island, I guess, would be the first one I would think of is this isn't real. And I remember as a kid watching it in reruns thinking, that's not possible. Where did that come from? You know, like when I was looking at, how did they get a movie camera all of a sudden? Like you would, but that was the escape sometimes that you turned to television for, right?
Well, you know, that's the old expression is, you know, are you willing to suspend your disbelief, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, Gilligan's Island was so fabricated, right? The whole show is just utterly, utterly fabricated, but they made it silly, and silly can work. Silly can often work.
Yeah.
By the way, I was not a fan of that show. I watched it, but I would sit there thinking, why are people laughing?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
You know, it was, but there was something strange and iconic about it. And everybody has watched it. You can't tell anybody something about, well, who did you like better? You know, which of the women did you like? And they'll be able to answer. They'll see the show.
But I would say as a kid, I was entertained by it. Like I was the Monkees and a few other shows. Now that I've watched a couple of them on the classic TV channels, they're tough. They're tough to watch.
they weren't going for big laughs. They were going for silliness, you know? And again, I think silliness can work, but It clearly, I would have not put that show on because it didn't make me laugh, but I would have been wrong.
Yeah.
Because obviously it stayed on and it still plays.
You do address TV themes in here, too. It's just such a shame that, you know, these TV shows always had a story, and you kind of knew, even if you jumped in for the first time to watch a program, you knew what it was all about. It kind of got you excited. It kind of built some momentum. And the TV theme is 10 to 15 seconds of instrumental music now. It's a shame because it's kind of almost an era gone by.
It is. And it's what is really interesting, Dave, is a lot of the people we interviewed would spontaneously, if we asked them about a show, like Paula Adlon, whose show is Better Things on Netflix, she spontaneously mentioned Welcome Back, Kotter. She spontaneously sang the entire theme.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Beautifully. Right?
Absolutely.
Tracy Jordan from 30 Rock can sing every single theme song of all time.
I love it.
He knows every single one of them.
I love it.
And you, and it gets in your head, obviously, especially when you were a kid and you watched episode after episode. The theme song got in your head, and you could sing it. Of course you could sing it.
No
you know,
question.
And yes, it was a fascinating part of it, and I do wish, like many other things about contemporary comedy, I wish they would go back and do some of these things again, because nothing proves it works more than the fact that if you look at Netflix and Amazon and all the other streamers, what is the show that's still the most watched on them? Oh, it's reruns of The Office. Oh, it's reruns of Cheers. Oh, it's reruns of Seinfeld. Those shows have an essence that is very difficult to match, but nobody's trying anymore.
Yeah.
They're not really trying to do it.
Tremendous docuseries. The History of the Sitcom airs Sunday nights at 8 Central on CNN. Bill, always a pleasure, and great job on this as always.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. Really appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you, sir.